Well, good afternoon. I'm glad you're all able to find the place. Everybody said you knew where it was. I was asking around yesterday and how it got such a crazy name, and somebody told me, and I think it was you, that this was named after the character in Hobbit, the kind of gruesome character that's always talking about my precious. Is that right? Yeah. Oh, really? What was the guy's name? I saw the movie, but it's. Excuse me? Gollum? No, it's Gollum. Okay. So, look at it. This is one of the highlights of your life. No matter where you work in future, you're never ever going to be in a room named after a character named Gollum in The Hobbit. You know, maybe after some vice president, or something like that. You know, the Thomas J. Watson, this or that, or the, Henry Ford, blah 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 blah, or whatever. But this is the only place I can imagine where you'd be working in a room named after a character of The Hobbit. So that I thought was interesting. Oh, we've got a few more customers come, more than a few coming in. They're finding a place slowly, slowly they come. Situation there. Also, this is kind of the first time I've been down to this area. So you've all heard of deja vu. To me, whenever I'm walking around here, I get something analogous called deja nu. And maybe you get this too. I turn around and says, "Hey, I never knew this was here." And apparently, there's some sort of bat cave or something down there I have to try that they promised me or whatever. And so, is it just me because I'm a newbie, or is it a case that even long-standing guys, you take a turn to the left when you should have been in the right and say, "Hey, I've never been here before," or "No, is this or something? This is the treasure room where all the epic gold is kept," or something like that. So they have probably a couple of hobbits or something with whatever hobbits habituate with or whatever. So anyway, let's get to business. I'm almost done grading the exam. I didn't quite finish it, and I still had to do some notation about storing the grades and all. So most people are doing well, and I kind of got a hint on that on Thursday when at least one person left after what, about 27 minutes. I was over. We were working on a project, a problem, and people started coming in and giving me the exam right after it started. So I think part of the issue, and I'm not going to change it just because of you, is that generally this is taught to an undergraduate audience. Primarily, it's about two-thirds undergraduates and maybe a third or smaller graduate students. So we've kind of got a slightly, not a slightly, a significantly higher level of capability. Now, don't tell that to the students back there because I may have to teach them some days. And you don't always tell your customers, that you're less than cream of the crop, but anyway, so that's it. So what I'll plan to do is when I get my grades out, I'll send information out to Piazza, and then you can log into Learn at UW, and they'll be entered in the grade section there. And then what I'll do is a week from today, I'll bring the blue books back and distribute them to you, and you're welcome to look over it, and if you see any issues. I'll also have answer keys for the particular exam. So I don't publish exam answer keys online, but I certainly do prepare. Excuse me, an answer key just so that I have a uniform standard against which to grade. So if, if I said this is only worth two-thirds, what was missing? Well, presumably the answer key would give you a more complete or more accurate answer. So in theory, if you did exactly the answer key, one, you'd get full points, and two, you'd get me very suspicious about why it was exactly like the answer key. But that's another issue. So basically what I want to do today is turn my attention to Project 4. I think all of you have got essentially the scanner. I'm not the scanner, the parser set. As I mentioned, if you got to the point where you're not quite sure that your parser is parsing and building the AST properly, what you can do is send to me or the TA personally an email, and we can send you a copy of the CUP file we used. And I prefer that you use your own sort of you break it, you bought it sort of approach. But if it's clear to you that the parser is not up to snuff, the other two sections won't work quite properly either because we require that there be a solid AST that you're working on. So rather than that, we'll simply go ahead and let you take a copy of what we're using. Hopefully, that's more nearly correct, and we'll go with that. So what Project 4 is essentially about is very simple in a lot of ways. You're just worrying about two types of information, essentially type and kind. And almost the whole project is really just acquiring type and kind information from declarations and setting it in various expressions and usages and checking for correctness. So really, it's about type and kind. And I made some suggestions for type or kind, but let me just switch over to my solution. This is essentially, and I'll read this through if it doesn't come through clearly. This is actually the types and kind I use. The notes I gave you were essentially the same. It's a suggestion of important things, but you may want to add or delete things as appropriate for your own implementation. So remember, types are pretty much like what we've seen in programming languages. And therefore, we have character, integer, Boolean, error. Error types are particularly important because they follow sort of the principle of garbage in, garbage out. What that means is it's entirely possible to have an error deep in a construct that sort of pollutes the type checking for the remainder of the construct. An example of that would be if I had A plus B times C. And lo and behold, I look up A. It should have a type in kind, but it's undeclared. Obviously, anything that's undeclared cannot be used to provide a valid type or kind. So in this particular case, I'm still deep in the checking for A plus B, and then after that, it's time C. So what should I do by way of checking? Since A does not have a type, I can't really say definitively whether plus B is valid or not. So the suggestion is whenever you have a construct, either an identifier or some sort of expression that you found to be erroneous, that you print out an error message, error such and such is undeclared. Then it's what you do is you change the type to error. And error, again, follows this garbage in, garbage out principle. It says you can't get meaningful results as output unless you have meaningful results as input. So that means essentially don't do any further checking on the plus operation on the left operand. It's entirely possible B may have an error. That's okay. That's a separate check. But in this case, you don't know what A's type would have been, so you can't say whether it's valid or invalid. Another little trick I play is that in our language, not necessarily in all languages, you can figure out what the result type of an expression is independent of its operands. If it's valid, it's got to be a particular type. In particular, plus has to be an integer type, no matter what the operands are. If they're erroneous, you got an error message. If they're legal, you didn't. Question? Oh, damn. Yeah, I am. Sorry. I mentally changed it. Yeah, thanks for reminding me. So in this particular case, plus is always going to return an int. So a trick I do is even if A or B operands are erroneous, I still return the type of plus as int because that's the only valid type plus can ever give. It may be that the operands of A and B have to be fixed up to make it a valid addition, but unless I change plus, and if you change plus, well then I can't tell you anything about what the resulting type check is going to be because it's a different program. So in this particular case, the result of A plus B would be int. That's because the garbage in and garbage out principle doesn't work in this case because plus always returns an int if it's valid. And therefore, you're going to assume that somebody wrote down something meaning to return a plus, and therefore you can check. And therefore, the time C might turn out a different message. So the notion is kind of to give meaningful messages where you can, but not to repeat messages or to mislead people with messages that don't make sense. People are always looking for extra credit. And here's a little cute one that you can do with the error type. Suppose we have an undeclared identifier. And again, that's not that uncommon an error. Many programmers, including myself sometimes, write the code first and write the declarations later. Now, certainly in the old days before Epic, I did that a lot. The notion was kind of code is the hard part, and the declarations are just kind of the window dressing to make the compiler happy. Now, that means in the case that if you forgot to put in the declaration or you mistyped it or something, you may have many uses of A, for example. So suppose I have A all over the place. I have this one, and I write out an error message, error. A is undeclared. Well, it's going to be a situation that if I have A in another situation, let's say it's like C gets A, what error message am I going to get when I check the A for the assignment? Error, A is undeclared. Because those are separate checks. And as many times as I have A, I'll have that many error messages. Now, in a way, that's not bad, but in another way, it is, because there's really just one error. And in theory, if you end up having a listing that says, here's seven errors, it ought to be seven different things that have to be fixed. Now, again, you can't always figure that out precisely, but it ought not to be the case that if I use A a lot and I have 100 different messages saying error A is undeclared, and, you know, you get 100 messages. First of all, you know, it's bad PR, and I'm sure you get that with your customers in the situation. You see 100 errors, say, my God, I'm doomed. Even if I do 10 minutes per error, it's going to take me all night and all day to fix it. When that's not true. So what you might like to do, and many compilers do it, is once they give you an error message that A is undeclared, they don't bother giving you succeeding error messages. Because once you fix the one, you presumably fix the rest. Now, if you wanted to do that by way of extra credit, because this is certainly not mandatory, can anybody think of a clever way of doing it in the context of what I just been talking about? I found A, error A is undeclared, and I realize if I use A repeatedly, I'll look it up each time and it'll still be undeclared. So what's the trick? A flag in sense. It's like that old joke I tell you, and it never gets a laugh, but I always thought it was funny that you go to the doctor and you say, oh, whenever I do this, it hurts. And what should I do, doc? He says, don't do that. So you say, whenever I look up A and I find it's undeclared, I have to print out an error message. What should I do, doc? Don't make it undeclared. But what should you declare it as? You don't know what the user had in mind. So if I said, okay, I printed out an error message, A is undeclared, the user knows that. They're going to fix that. There may be others, maybe not. How could I change it so if there are other A's, I can suppress these additional error messages? That's all I want to do. So one fix may fix all the occurrences where A occurs. Answer is I put a declaration in the symbol table. But what type do I give it? Error. It certainly is a valid, sensible thing. And remember, the rule on error is garbage in, garbage out. If the thing is error, you're not going to generate any additional error messages. So it's not going to create any bogus sort of flows. It's going to say, this guy is nonsense. Ignore him. You would have done that anyway. But in this particular case, you don't get the associated redundant error about A being undeclared. So you don't have to do that, but I think it's a cute little trick. It's pretty easy to do, and I think it improves the overall quality of the compiler. So that's something that I wanted to point out. So let's go back then. What we're talking about is type and kind, and we'll go back to the listing I had, and I wanted to go through those. So we were talking about type. We had character, integer, Boolean. That's pretty much driven by the definition of the language. Error, which we're familiar with. Unknown is a good one for an initial value situation there. When you first create something and you haven't done any type checking at all, if you have to have an initial value for a type, unknown makes a reasonable sense. Unknown just means that. It could be valid, it could be not, I don't know, and probably doesn't make any sense to check. If you see something that's unknown, that means there's been an error, that somehow that type ought to have been created properly before you got around to checking it. And void, remember, void is used in methods where you have a potential return type, but if a void method is used not as a function but as a subroutine. So that's a trick that goes all the way back to C and still being used. Let's go down and look at kinds. Var means it's a scalar variable. And I'm getting around to people who are asking me, what are all this nonsense about scalar or arithmetic and all that? How can I handle those? And I'll show you some ideas on that momentarily. We have value. That means it's not assignable. So a constant or an expression is a value. So what's the kind of A plus B? Its type is int, as I said a moment ago, and it's a value, which means it can be read because it could be passed as a parameter, for example, but it may not be assigned to. You cannot assign to an expression in most languages. It's an array or a method. An array parameter, that just simply distinguishes that array parameters are a little different in that array parameters don't have a size associated with them, arrays do. The reason for that is an array parameter takes the size of the corresponding actual array that's passed to it at runtime. The reason for that is in very early languages like Pascal, the size of an array was actually part of its type. People figured out really quickly that was a terrible idea because that means that if you had a sorting routine that sorted 100 integers, that has a different type than a sorting routine that sorts 99 integers. And that's crazy. So the way they fix it now is that you have a routine that sorts an array of integers, and the type is discerned by either doing something about asking the size of the array or maybe passing in an extra parameter. It says, please sort these arrays assuming that they have this many elements. So at least gives you the flexibility to have arrays, different size arrays of the same base type be used interchangeably. So we have an array parameter, a scalar parameter. That means really just a non-array parameter. Sometimes it's useful. You'll find in many cases an array parameter and a variable. A scalar parameter and a variable are interchangeable. The difference is later when we go ahead and do code generation or optimization, many compilers treat parameters differently in terms of allocating memory. We won't have quite as much of that because we'll be doing JVM that doesn't have registers. But all real machines have registers. And one of the rules is you put frequently used values in a register. Well, when you're calling a subroutine, what values are likely to be used? Namely, the parameters. If I'm calling something that says, do the max or min of A and B, it's likely to look at A and B real soon to figure out which is the max and which is the min. So that's that. We have string. And yeah, there was some, I think the notes were not consistent on this. I think we had a little dialogue on Piazza, and we decided that if you have string literals, a good way to do that is the kind of string. String being an odd kind, it's not quite an array of characters, but it's a conglomeration, that's a good technical term, of characters, sort of like a constant array, like that. And therefore, its resulting type would be character. So you could have a character array, and you could have a character string. And just trying to make it match, I think that's the closest match we'll get. Visible label and hidden label. And then we have other. Other is, again, I don't know, it's good like an initial value. It's none of the above, so it's something other. Now, I got questions also about what's this hidden label and visible label business. I'll talk more about that, but since I'm in the context of it now, let me slip back. We've gotten some questions about labels. And under the rules of CSX, labels do not interfere with any other kind of identifier. That's because labels are used in a very restricted context. They only appear on a while loop. If, as extra credit, you create for loops, you'll probably want to allow labels on for loops also. And the only way a label can be used is as a break or continue. And if you're familiar to language, you've got to be inside of a loop. And break or continue says relative to this loop. You put a label on it because you can have loops nested. And you're saying which loop do I want to break out of or which loop do I want to continue with. And that gives you a way to tell. So we use labels because what's our choice? Early programming languages use integers. But I don't think that's a particularly great choice either. If you just want to give the things numbers, you can do what we'll do later in code generation, namely create all labels as L1, L2, L3, L367, sort of like they do on AOL or some of those other frequently used services when you have a common name. It's gotten to be at the university, too. It's a situation, you have an unusual name if the digits that follow your last name, typically your login is your last name. If you're Wiebelfitzer 3, that's great. That means you're one of rarity. But if you have a really common name like Lou or Lin or Lee or something, it's 372 or something like that. And I guess if you go back to China, they might need double precision or something to decide, which of Lees or Lus or Lins you happen to be. So we have to handle labels if only because when we reference a label, we have to find out whether it exists or not. So there's actually two ways of doing it. You don't want to put it in the same symbol table as everything else because it clashes so weakly that there's no purpose on letting the clash like that. Suppose you have a label named sum for some crazy reason. If you have a variable named sum, there's absolutely no conflict. You can't add labels, nor can you break out of an integer. So if you say sum in the context of a label, it's a label. If you say sum in the context of a non-label, it's a non-label. So one thing people do, and you're welcome to do this, is create yourself a little symbol table. A little because you're going to have many fewer labels than anything else. So you have the big symbol table. And it's just big because it contains all the other identifiers, variables, parameters, constants, method names, everything except labels. And then the little tiny one. And the tiny one would only contain labels. Now, that's perfectly fine. There's no rule that symbol tables have to be big or small or anything in between. But there's also a rule that says you can only access a label when you're inside of a loop. It doesn't make sense to break out of a loop if you're not in the loop. It doesn't make sense to continue with a loop if you're not in the loop. So how, if I have these little symbol tables, do I remember, am I currently in a loop or not? And one way to do it, and that's what this sort of anticipated, was that when you first touch the top of a loop, so you say, here's L, and this is a while, and it has an expression and presumably a body. L is first discovered when you touch the while loop. At that point, it becomes visible, and it's visible and hence usable throughout the body of the loop. When you hit the end of the loop and you exit the loop, the while in terms of checking, it's no longer accessible. So it goes from visible loop, a visible label, I should say, to hidden label. So if you want to do it that way, that's why those two things exist. Because inside the scope, which might be the body of a method, you'll be in part of that body of the method will be a while loop, like this guy, but not the entire body. So if you have a symbol table, that symbol table is created and left when you open a new method. So when you get a new method, you get the big table and the little table. And the little table has things that are sometimes visible and sometimes not. So that's one way of doing it, and it's a perfectly fine way of doing it. But in some way, it's overkill because this thing is so tiny. So I thought about it a while, and I held my nose, and finally I said, nah, this is not the greatest way of doing it. So the way I do it in my solution, you don't have to do it this way, but you might consider it as an option, is I have a list instead of a symbol table. And the list is essentially of all the labels that are currently visible from where I am. So what happens is when I hit L, I go ahead and add L to the head of the list. Why do I have a list? Well, because loops nest. Inside a while, I can have another while. So while, blah, and another while, blah. And if you generalize and include for loops, you certainly remember many cases where you have for loops nested within for loops. So in this particular case, when I'm right here, where X marks the spot, I potentially have two labels available. The label on the inner while and the label on the outer while. If I had labels on those two, say, call this L2 and this L1, then in this particular case, I'd have a list that would have L2 at the head and L1 further down. The reason for that is the nesting rules, scoping rules, are the same in all languages, namely the nearest definition applies. So in this case, if right here I said break L1, I'd look up the list and say, well, give me all the labels that are currently visible. If none of them are visible, I have an error message. Error label so-and-so does not name any current while loop. So I'd look up L2, nope, check the next one, L1, winner. So I know that this guy is talking about that loop up there. And right now for checking, I don't do much more, but later on when we do code generation, that means when I go inside and decide to break out of that loop, that's the loop I got to break out of. I got to go to its end rather than the end of the inner while. As I mentioned, one of the oddities about labels is that they can't even clash with themselves. It's one of these sort of situations. If you study physics, there are some particles like neutrinos that are so weakly interacting that they never touch anything. No, they just float around and never touch anything at all. So if I happen to have a situation where I had label L repeatedly used, that's not erroneous because now I get to use my scoping rule. Remember, the rule is always the innermost visible definition applies. So in this case, of course, X would have to say break L. And all the effect would be is that the inner L would be the one I'm talking about. The outer L would be hidden. Well, isn't that terrible? Well, maybe it is, but you made the choice as a programmer. If you decided to name two labels L, the rule is always the innermost definition is the one that is used first. That's the same in variables or anything else. If I have nested blocks, the innermost definition in a block takes precedence, otherwise the containing and the containing. So we're following the same rule in this context as in others. So in that case, if I do it this way, I don't really need this visible and hidden business anymore because it's implicit on the list. If you're on the list, you're visible. If you're not on the list, you're not visible. So I left those in there just as kind of a reminder of the old days. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you just have difficulty throwing things away. So in this situation, I left it in there, but you don't need to use it. And that's why it's there. So I thought I'd explain that to you. That's limited to the spot you currently are at. Remember that as we're walking the tree, we're entering bodies of things and leaving bodies of things. So yes, it's certainly with respect to the current method we're in, but more than that, let's go back. I still have it up here. Right here where X marks the spot, a check here might be very different than a check there. Because in here, I'm in the context of two nested while loops. When I get to there, this one while loop has been exited. What does that mean? Well, I'm showing you the linearization, but that means I walked into a while node. It had a little tiny expression that was the Boolean. I checked that to make sure it's Boolean, and it might have had a big body. Some programs have a loop body that's quite large. So I walked through that whole thing. It's a block, and inside blocks, we have a list of statements, and each statement has a body, so I can have loops within loops or ifs within ifs or whatever I care to. But there's a standard ordering for this. You walk the things, you walk statements left to right, you walk a tree, normally visits its children, and then you process the node itself. And at some stage, I'll be at the point of the tree that represents something past the innermost while, but still inside the outer while. In this case, the check is different because in this case, let's go back to my L1 and L2. Back here, L2 is gone. Just like when I close a block, I close the symbol table. When I leave a while, I make inaccessible the label on that loop because it's no longer relevant. Outside that loop, nobody can ever use that L for any purpose at all because the only time a label can be accessed is inside the body of the loop that it accesses. That's why I use identifiers, but they're not really quite like the scoping of all other things. We kind of use them because what else would we use? You can't use numbers. You don't use identifiers. What are you going to use? Yes, we could create some brand new symbol that had some oddball character beginning it, but then people say, oh, what's that? You know, and why did you bother and all? So historically, that's the way we did it. Question?
Mm-hmm. That method has another while loop. You mm-hmm. cannot break out to the first while loop out of the method.
Anymore. That's right. That's right. Because remember, in the situation, breaks and continues exit loops, but they never cross. They're not like exceptions. They never cross method call boundaries. And that's quite intentional because otherwise, can you imagine what it'd be like if you had a library routine deciding to break out of a loop that you created? I mean, what are you doing with my loop? You know, you don't own this sort of thing. So they decided not to do that. And that's probably a wise move. So, okay, that's a little bit about what we're going to be doing today, type and kind. But also, let me give you a couple of tricks that I use in my solution. Many of you have already started to invent this, but I think I'll tell you about them because it's very useful. One thing you notice is a lot of cases in the assignment, I talk about things that this has to be a scalar or that has to be arithmetic. Well, what the heck does this mean and how do I enforce it? Well, what it means is in terms of see if my guy is dead. Come on, guy, come back to life. Whenever I say scalar or non-scalar or label or whatever else, oops, I don't want that. It always ends up in terms of type and kind, as I mentioned earlier. But the trick I'm going to talk about is essentially creating yourself a series of methods. And the reason for this is you're going to notice you're going to ask the same question over and over. So in a number of places, I say something is scalar. So what I'm going to recommend is you create yourself a little Boolean method that takes a parameter that represents a particular node that has a type and a kind. And you have a method called isScalar. And normally what happens is you do checking on things that have already been type checked or already have a type. So this would typically be something where you fetched out the node and you have its type and kind available. And what isScalar would do is take the parameter. So what you're going to do, let's take an example of that. One of the rules is what has to be a scalar? Well, one of the things that has to be a scalar is if you have an index into an array. So I'm checking a sub I. If you remember the little button, there's two things that have to be checked. One of them, I, has to be arithmetic. What does arithmetic mean? It means it's either of type integer or type char, and it has to be scalar. Sometimes people forget to do that second check, but notice if I were an integer array, it would not make any sense to index A by an integer array. I don't know any language that allows that, maybe experimental languages, but it wouldn't make sense. So you'd have to say, is this scalar? What would scalar mean? So going back here, what things are scalar? Well, things in this particular case, we'd have to have a var is scalar, a memory variable, a value is scalar, and that's the only ones. Arrays are not, methods are not, strings are not, and labels are not. So what you want to do then is go ahead and create yourself a little predicate that says, here are all the things I have to check. Is scalar, is arithmetic, is array, is not array, whatever you want to call it in situation, and it takes the object whose type and kind you'd be checking. So normally you'd be taking, here's something that has a type and a kind, and you're going ahead and saying, well, just check its type being this or that. But after a while, you kind of say, I forget what exactly scalar means. So what you do is you program it once and go ahead and do that. So this would be something that would return a Boolean and says, did this meet the requirement of being a scalar, being an array, being arithmetic, whatever? So whenever you have this sort of test, he says, oh, he wants it to have this property. You can go ahead. Another one is assignable. That's one thing. Assignable is used when you're going ahead and what can be assigned to. Something on the left-hand side has to be assignable. So you can't assign to a named constant. You can't assign to the name of a method. You can't even assign to the value that a method returns because that's a value. So you have something is assignable. That means may be changed. Another case that's obvious is when you're doing a read. When you're doing a read, read is really do some I/O and then assign the thing into the variable in the read list. That's an assignment. So when you're checking a read list, among other things, it has to be assignable. If I had the name of a constant, I could not read in a new value for the constant any more than I could assign to it. So you'll see these sort of things from time to time where you've written one of these and say, hey, didn't I just write this thing? I'm going to write another one. Go ahead and do it if you'd like to. But going ahead and making a method is a good way of doing it. So that's one trick, and you can kind of see what I'm getting at. There's another one that makes life even easier, and that's the case where all this thing does is take some type or kind information and check on it. Another thing you can do, however, is say, well, there's certain rules that something must be or must not be. Let me do the must be, but the not, must not be is related. So it says there's a rule that says that this particular value, like my index and array, must be a scalar. Notice this may use the is scalar, but the cool thing about must be is it takes the, let's say must be scalar, write it down. Well, it's a take as a parameter the thing that must be scalar. But the other thing it takes in is an error message. And this guy does the full checking. It says, and here's, so this is the item to be checked. And this is the message. Because in many cases, you do similar checking, but you may have a slightly different error message. So for example, if I'm trying to read into something that must be assignable, if I do that in an assignment, I'd say error, the left-hand side of an assignment must be assignable. If I have it in a read, I don't have quite that same error message. I say error, a parameter in a read list must be assignable. It's very similar, but it's not quite the same wording. So what to do is, what you do is, you essentially say must be scalar. You have the item that you want to check to be scalar, and you have the thing that prints the error, that has the text of the error message, and then it contains all the boilerplate that says, okay, here's the line number, here's the message, error line so-and-so, the left-hand side of an assignment must be assignable. That way, all the work about setting up the error message is done once in when you code this must be scalar. And as you might imagine, other must be methods are very similar. So you'd have a must be scalar, must be assignable, must be non-array, which is a different thing. Must be a method. If you're calling something, it must be a method. You can't call a label. You can't call a variable, whatever. I guess in some languages you can. Is it the case that cache is one of these languages where I can actually call a string and it fetches through the string name and calls a method? Oh, isn't that beautiful? Oh, my God. Debugging that must be such fun. I'm envious of you. I really am. Yes. So anyway, this is a couple of tricks that, so when we're going around, and I'm going to be taking you through in the bulk of the lecture some various ASTs, and it says check that this is true, check that that is true. What this is really is an abbreviation in pseudo-English saying call the method that does the checking. Is this a scalar? Call the method and have it tell you. If it must be something, that means if it is not, You have an error message, and you print the error message through the method, and you're done with it. The cool thing about this is, many cases, the actual checking you do for a given AST node is very limited. And I think that's a big plus. So let me go back to this a little bit. And it turns out that these two types are in the AST node. And a few of you have noticed, and many others will be, that I've gone ahead and added type and kind information into some, but not all AST nodes. The reason they're not in all AST nodes is many things in an AST don't have a type or kind. They're declarations. The main things that have types or kinds are expressions or variables or values. So going way down, let's see if I can find it here. I should just do a find. So I'm looking for expert node. Expert node is, I use too many of them, don't I? Did I just miss it?
No, I was asking why not in your search.
Class space.
Oh, good idea. Duh, because you're brighter than I am. Yeah, there we go. So let me close that. So what happens is at this stage and all the nodes that are children of this. So these are essentially things like literals, expressions, names, anything that produce a value. We're going to want to have type and kind. And I put that in the AST node because part of the side effect of type checking will be to leave information in the abstract syntax tree saying what type and kind I figured this out to be. Why is that relevant? Well, suppose I have an assignment. If I'm assigning arrays, I'm going to generate rather different code than if I'm assigning scalars. Or if I'm assigning a string into a character array, which is legal, I'm going to have to generate different code. So I have to have type and kind information in there telling me here's the circumstance of this particular AST, and that'll guide the code I generate. So in this case, it says used for type checking this node, blah, 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 blah. In this case, I said types equal error. I'm not sure I'm happy that other is fine. Maybe error should be unknown, but that's the way it's coded, and I'll leave it there. Now, one of the cool things about doing this is some of the type checking you can actually do in the parser. Why is that? Well, type checking in certain trivial cases is a no-brainer. So if, for example, I have an integer literal sitting somewhere, like A gets 1, 2, 3. By now, you're familiar with the fact that 1, 2, 3 in the AST is an intlit node. Well, this has to have a modest amount of type checking, but really nothing can go wrong. So type checking is even perhaps a bad name. It really is just type resolution. Because how do I know that 1, 2, 3 has to be a valid integer literal? Because Mr. Scanner and Mr. Parser did a lot of work to verify that. If it wasn't an integer literal, it wouldn't have been scanned or parsed as an integer literal. If that's the case, when I build this AST node, and an intlit node is a child of an expert node because an expression can be integer literal, I already know what the type and kind is. When I build that tree, I can say its kind is going to be value, its type is going to be int or integer. And I'm done. That means when I get around to type checking for that particular node, no checking is needed. Now, that's the way I do it. Now, that's not the only way to do it. An alternative would be to leave the type and kind always initialized when the tree is created to something innocuous like unknown. In this case, what do we use? Other, kind is other, and type might be error or unknown, one or the other. With the notion being that when you're going to go ahead and do type checking, even trivial type checking would set the type and kind for things like the intlit node. So this is purely a pay me now or pay me later. Do it either way, but do it uniformly. But if you see, you know, why did I have those fields in there? It's because when I'm doing type checking, I'm going to have to set those fields up to do further type checking. So that means as I'm doing type checking, and I'm walking that tree, remember those are our binary app nodes, I look up A and B, check those for correctness. I then set the type of this expression. Remember I said a moment ago, that's going to be int, and it's a value. That's so when times goes in there, it says, what is that subtree? Is that a valid subtree? Well, type is integer, that's fine for multiplication, and value is fine. So it's going to go ahead and propagate that along. So I'm going to decorate those trees with type and kind information to allow me to propagate information up the tree, and later on when I do code generation, use it to guide code generation. When it sees this tree, it says, what kind of types are you doing? Are you doing integers? We don't have floating point, but real languages do. Does Cache have floating point? I assume it probably does. Yes? Yeah, I think most do. And there's a case where plus and minus and all that can be integers or floating point, and there you'd have to distinguish for purposes of code generation. I did not put floating point in because I thought that was cruel to add yet another couple of types. Essentially, numbers are the concept we want, but real languages do need floating point and integers as two alternatives, and a more complete language would have those. So I think going into, we're going to then resume in terms of the type checking. Are any questions about what I've just talked about, just setting things up? This is sort of like a memory dump of things that I remember was important when I was doing it so that I can warn you in advance. Some of you will still make the errors, but at least in this case, I said, didn't I tell you? And being able to say I told you so is one of the great pleasures of life, at least at my age. So let's go back and get into our notes. Yeah, so here's, so here's that type and kind info. Oh, come on. Oh, one more time, okay. Oh, it's getting there. There we go, okay. Sometimes I wonder about these laptops. Do you think they put in a little clock or something? You know, like there are certain insects that last 7 days and then they die. It seems like this thing, I just bought this thing a little over a year ago and it's starting to get the slows already. And I start to wonder if they look clock, you know, that, well, you know, you got to slow it down so the person will decide after two or three or however many years to buy a new one. What is Epic? How long does Epic allow before you get to get a new laptop, assuming you're one of the lucky ones who gets one? Do they get you one every 3 years or they make you wait five or seven or some god-awful number?
Three.
That's a reasonable compromise, I think, in terms, or four. Right. As long as you don't have to get the hand-me-downs. That's something like, I was the oldest in the family, so I never suffered that. But if you're ever the youngest in the family, getting the hand-me-downs was always the worst. And getting hand-me-downs, laptops too. So my old laptop is actually being used by a TA teaching CS407. And by the way, that's one of the things that we're trying to get brought out here. Has anybody heard of CS407? If we get it out here, I think you'd love it. It's mobile computing platforms, but what that really means is programming apps. I kind of wish I could go back and do it because one of the class projects is you program up your own app. And some of the apps have been so cool, people have been trying to market them. I don't know if there have been any investors willing to drop real money into them, but you know, do apps. And it's always amazing, you know, what you can see what people are thinking about in terms of apps. Like about half of them have to do with food. You know, find by consensus which is the best pizza today, because not all pizzerias have the same pizza every day and things like that. Imagine, I don't know if you have them here, but you have what, two cafeterias now or three? Three. So you can imagine you're going through there, you know, and you can set a profile, you know, I love tacos, you know, but I hate hot dogs and burgers are so-so. And it kind of guides you, you know, says, you know, you should turn left and it takes you to the ideal cafeteria. So that'd be a great app if they allow you to develop those. So some of this I've already gone through, so I just want to back. This is stuff we already talked about. And I wanted to make sure to remind myself to get it through again. I think what you've been through, you should certainly read these notes if you haven't already. And yeah, this is where I wanted to start. So what we're doing here, this can be very helpful to you too, is what I've tried to do here is go through most, if not quite all, the important AST notes. Now, there's some trivial things that I'm not going to insult you by worrying about. So there's something called a true note. What's a true note? It's the AST node for the reserved word true. Now, you got to figure out either in the parser or in the type checker what the type and kind of true is. So what's the type of true, would you imagine? Huh? Boolean. Hey, you're getting the thing. And what's its kind? It's a value. So there's something like that. I'm not going to just by and mention that. If you can't figure those out, you know, you're in the wrong group. Now, I've been teaching more years than I care to, and there was this great movie called The Paper Chase. You may have seen it. And it's about being in law school, and there's this old prof, or the guy, I guess to the student's point of view, he's old, John Houseman. And at one stage, he catches a student who's really screwed up, and he goes into his pocket, and let's see if I got it. And he hands the guy a quarter, and he says, please go and call your mother and tell her you're never going to be a lawyer. So I never had the crew with you say, you know, here's a quarter, go call your parents, tell them you're never going to be computer scientists or computer professionals. Here it kind of not make any sense because you're already hired on. So I guess I'd have to call Judy and say somebody made a mistake, but I wouldn't do that either. So at any rate, what we have here are some fairly simple ones and then the more complex ones. And I'm hoping to get through this today. And this will be the bulk of what I think you need to be able to do project four. So let's start out with some fairly straightforward ones. And we're going to differentiate when you're doing an AST node to two different classes. One of them is declarations. And usually the name kind of tells you, like var decl node. But what a declaration says is you're not checking so much as entering information. So declarations typically put something in the tree or in the symbol table for future reference. So it says, I'm a var decl node. And again, you've through parsing, so you know these trees are sound in terms of what's there, what's promised is there. So you don't have to check, does this guy have a valid type node and a valid ident node? He does. Another thing happens is when I visit a node for type checking, the node controls what I do. But idents are kind of oddballs because they're used two different ways. They're used as declarations, but they're also used as uses. So how do I distinguish it? If I visit ident node, how does this poor guy know whether I'm declaring the ident or trying to look it up as, say, part of an expression? The easiest way to my mind to do this is I never actually go and visit an ident node by doing a visit on it if it's a declaration. If it's a declaration, I stay in the parent and just go down to the child and fetch out his name. That means when I go and visit an ident node, it'll already be declared and it'll go ahead and in a usage of an ident node to say, look up ABC, fill in what its type and kind are for future reference. And that will actually go in the AST because remember, an ident node is in the subtree of an expr node, and expr nodes in the AST now have a type and kind. So notice this when it happens. I'm never going to actually visit ident node by calling a visit to it. I'm going to simply look down the linkage and say, okay, an ident node has to have a name. That's what I really care about. Let's look it up. So it says, check that ident node dot ID name is not already in the symbol table. This is, whenever I say check that, what am I really saying? I'm saying print out an error message if this is not satisfied. And I'm not even telling you what the error message is. You can look at some of the sample runs I have in a handout or come up with your own. But again, any reasonably coherent message would be fine. So it says, check that ident node is not already in the symbol table. If it is, that's a multiple declaration error. So you'd print out an error message and handle it. So if I'd gone ahead and done that, then some of these remaining steps are aborted. Clearly, if the thing's already declared, I don't have to set up a node for the new declaration. The new declaration isn't going to work. So whenever it says check that, you say if it fails, do I go ahead and do the remainder of the tests? In this case, number two says, well, put them in the symbol table. Well, obviously, I'm not putting them in the symbol table if it's already declared. The rule is first come, first served. Later declarations are illegal, get error messages, and presumably are fixed. So what do we do here? Well, in this particular case, we extract the type from the type node. So this could be an int, a char, a bool, whatever it happens to be. And its kind is variable. So in this particular case. Remember, we have a similar thing for array declaration. So I can have an array decal node, and that'll be slightly different, of course, because in this case, its kind is going to be an array, not, in this case, a variable. So those are the first two checks. There's a variation on this that says I can have an initializer. So that's all just the old thing, int I equals zero sort of thing. Well, first of all, how do I distinguish this guy from that guy? Notice that they're var decal nodes, and it has an ident node, a type node, and an expert node. The earlier one I showed you was really just an abbreviation, wasn't it? Because remember, all nodes have the same number of children, all of the same kind. So a var decal node always has yay many children. So what happened in the earlier one, what was expert tree represented as? A null node. Well, how can I tell that? So what I really did is, I didn't show you this, but now I'm telling you, I did that just to make it a little simpler. I somehow figured out I had this configuration and not the one on the next slide. How did I figure that out? I mean, it's one thing looking at it, but when you're programming, you don't see nodes. You see fields, and you know, this is logic. You've got to program it. So remember, there's this little magic thing that we're going to use a lot. And you can go to any node and say, are you null? So it's a situation there. I can go to that third field and say, are you null? If he's null, that means I essentially have that situation. There's no initializer if he's null. So what this thing is really saying, if the third subtree, let's go back to him, the expert node tree, whatever the darn thing is called, we'll see it here in a minute. I say, if you're null, I'm doing slide one. If you're not null, that means you have an initializer. I'm going to do slide two. So these are really two checks within the same node, and we know that because they're both var decal nodes. So here are the steps again. Some of them are the same. I'm going to check again to see if he's declared or not. I'm going to type check the initial value of the expression. How do I do that? When I say type check, what does that mean? It just means visit that particular subtree. And notice that subtree could be complex. It's normally something simple, but it could be an expression. It could be a function call. Anything it happened to be. Anything that's a legal expression is valid in that context. So it goes ahead and walks the tree. And what it does is, at the end, the root of that tree is going to have type and kind information in it. And that's how I'm going to be able to check to see whether or not the assignment to the identifier is valid or not. So if, for example, I declared this thing as an integer, but I gave it an expression and returned a Boolean, it's got to get an error message. And it's the same error message as an assignment, saying you cannot have a right-hand side, this thing being assigned, the initializer, have a different type than what you have on the left-hand side, the variable. In this language, I've kept it simple by requiring they always be the same. Some languages like Java and C and probably other languages, cache, sometimes have rules that do automatic typecasting, automatic changes. So many, many languages that have floats say, if I assign an integer into a float, that's perfectly okay. The notion is every integer has a corresponding float, and what you really meant is put the .0 on it, but you were too lazy to do it. So it says that's valid, and we'll do some type conversion as we go along. We don't have that in our language. If you wanted to, you could have an expression that returned a Boolean and then typecast it into an integer. That would be allowed. And that would mean whatever the Boolean was, you change it to an integer. And the way you do that is a false is 0 and a true is 1. So if you wanted to get a hold of the numeric value of the Boolean, you could do it by typecasting. And we'll get to casting a little later on. So we check the initial value. And this may produce error messages. Notice that as you're walking a tree, you may produce a number of different error messages. It might be the case that something in the expression tree has, say, our old uninitialized identifier and gets an error message. But then the result type comes back as Boolean, and you get a second message saying, even if you get this problem with the undeclared identifier, you're still going to have to face the fact that Boolean may not be assigned to integer. So one tree may have many errors, I'm sure. When you learn programming, you figure that out. Check that the initial value's type is the type node. That's just saying, and here's a situation where my predicate comes into play. So he says, here's the thing that says type must be, and you fish out the type from type node.type, and you call the method type must be blah. And if it isn't that, you print out an error message. Error, type so-and-so is illegal or not what was expected or whatever you have. Check that the initial value is kind of scalar. That might be the case that I tried to initialize with an array and forgot to put a subscript on it. That's illegal. I can't use an array to initialize a single variable, so that gets an error message. And here's a definition of what scalar means. It means it's a variable, a value, or a scalar param. So when I said, is scalar, that's what I was talking about earlier, you pre-program, is scalar saying, is that particular value, that particular kind, I should say, a variable, a value, or a scalar. That's a series of ifs or however you want it. Program it once and just use it whenever you need it. And then, assuming that everything's gone fine, you go ahead and put it in the symbol table with type equal type node and kind equals variable. Even if the initializer was messed up, you can still put it in the symbol table. Probably should, because the initializer is wrong, but the type checking with respect to the variable name is still going to be sound. So any questions about that? Now, so the cool thing about this, each one of these is fairly limited. So one of the cool things about doing a big project is being able to break it up into pieces. That's particularly true if you have a partner. If you don't have a partner, you may wish you had one in this case, because it's easy to say, partner, you do this half, and I'll do that half. And of course, you pick out the easy half and give the partners the other half. So the ones later on are the harder ones in case you're doing the assignment of who does what. Even you're doing it by yourself, and that's still certainly doable, it's the case that if you have a spare time here or there or whatever, do one or two nodes, some of the simpler ones, and you're done. And once that type and checking is correct, you don't have to worry about it anymore. You just have more and more nodes. And when all the rules on all the nodes are enforced, you're good to go. So constant declarations, that's kind of like a variable declaration. The difference is, notice there's no type node here because we have this rule that says the type of a constant is equal by definition to the type of the initializer. So if I say TWO equals number 2, that's fine. I know that TWO is of type int. So what are my steps? Again, I check that it's not already in the symbol table, so you could have a little method that says check, you know, for previous declaration or something. So if you see these things occurring a lot, that's a hint, 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 create a method and just call the method and make your life easy. Type check the constant values expression. So you go to the tree and visit it and say, type check yourself, guy. This constant's value has to be a scalar. There again, I get the definition, but now you have is scalar to go ahead and do that for you. Oops. We put them in the symbol table as type is constant, is the type of the expression, and as kind is value. So unlike a variable, a variable's had type var, or kind var, this has kind value. Okay, and that's all I had on that one. That was pretty straightforward. Now we're type checking ident nodes in the context where they're actually used as an identifier with some lookup. So now we're going to end up doing some lookup. So we look him up, and of course, error if he's absent. That means his type becomes error because we don't know what it would be, and kind is unknown or whatever we happen to have, other or whatever. So if we looked him up and he's not in there, he gets an error message, and some of these further steps have to be modified. Copy the symbol table's entry in kind into the ident node. So here's where we need the symbol table. I declared I up above, and all of a sudden I have a use of I, and I have to remember that in this particular case, the use of I has the type the declaration gave me. So I go ahead and get that in there. Again, if he was undeclared, then the type is probably error, and kind is unknown or other or something like that. The error type is really the important issue, saying, well, he didn't have a valid declaration, so don't do any further checking based on the type because it's not there. Store a link into the symbol table entry, the ident node, in case you need further information. And okay, in fact, on a later version, I think later in, I changed that to red just to do that. So if you have notes in front of you, put a little marker in there because this is something that you don't need now, but you will need for the final project step. What happens is I've looked up the identifier and I have information about it. But when I do code generation, I may want to go back up and look further information about the identifier. Like he's an integer, I may want to say, what's his memory location? in the computer's memory. I can't assign that yet because I'm not into code generation yet, but how do I go ahead and get information that's in the symbol table after the symbol table is gone? And the way I do it is I have sort of a philosophy that I'll pay for something once, but I sure as heck I'm not going to pay for it twice. So in this case, I paid for the identifier lookup mechanism by doing the symbol table lookup. I did whatever checking it says. Here's an identifier I, figure out where he is in the declaration. And it says, okay, here's the declaration for I. I now know what that is. That's never, ever going to change. So what I do is I create this special link from the ident node back to the symbol table entry so that I never need a symbol table again. Why? Well, I have a direct link. Why would I go through a symbol table when I just link it back? Okay, that's probably a good time to take a break. We'll go back and continue on this, and hopefully we'll get through most or all of this by the end of tonight. I'll take 10 minutes as usual.